for me, I realized that this was going to change my life and women's sports. And it was going to be a time for me to take really responsibility and figure out, you know, how to do it. But it was a real turning point. I often say in a marathon that this particular marathon, that I started that marathon as a girl and I finished it as a grown woman, because it just gave me the insight for the rest of my life.
That was Catherine Switzer, and she's talking about the historic day in 1967 when she became the first woman to register and run in the Boston Marathon. Her feat was captured in one of the world's most famous sports photos when a race official physically attacked her and tried to throw her out of the race. Catherine finished the marathon. It was the start of a long career working to bring equality to women in sports around the world. I'm Milan Verveer, and this is Seneca's 100 Women to Hear. We are bringing you 100 of the world's most inspiring and history-making women you need to hear. Catherine Switzer was inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame in October of 2011. For her undeniable impact in creating positive global social change. Among her achievements, she was instrumental in getting the Olympics to finally include a women's marathon event in 1984. And if that weren't enough, she's an accomplished author, having written the memoir Marathon Woman, as well as Running and Walking for Women Over 40. Catherine continues to use her power for purpose as the founder of the global nonprofit 261 Fearless, which works to break down barriers of geography to create a global community for women runners. Listen and learn why Catherine Switzer is one of Seneca's 100 women to hear. I'm so thrilled to be here today with Catherine Switzer, an American marathon runner, author, commentator. In fact, she's been called running's most iconic figure. It's so great to have you, Catherine.
Thank you, Milan. I'm delighted to be here.
I know that you created one of those most memorable moments in sports history when you ran in the Boston Marathon back in 1967. Now, as I recall, women were not allowed to enter, but you registered under your initials, and you were attacked by an official who tried to throw you out. So perhaps you can share with us why you decided to run the race and what happened.
Well, Milan, it's so great being here and able to talk to you and so many women who are listening. It's so hard to imagine that 54 years ago, an official did do that in the Boston Marathon and that women were not permitted to run. But, you know, there were no rules printed about this.
Oh.
So, yes, it's amazing. My coach at the time was a university mailman at Syracuse University. He had run 15 Boston marathons. And when I showed up on the men's cross-country course to train with the men, they wouldn't let me run officially. But the men were wonderful, and they let me train with them. I couldn't keep up with the men. And Arnie Briggs, the mailman, was injured and old. I mean, he was 50, you know, he was really old. and a volunteer coach, and he sort of took me under his wing and jogged with me every day. But he had run all these Boston marathons, and to keep me my mind off the running and preoccupied and entertained, he would tell me another Boston marathon story. And so I was kind of growing up in my running with hearing these amazing stories. And one day I told him that I wanted to run the Boston Marathon also. And he said, "Don't be ridiculous. A woman can't possibly run a marathon distance." And we were running 10 miles in a blizzard in Syracuse that night. He said this. And everybody knows Syracuse is horrible weather. And so I said, "Come on, Arnie, don't be ridiculous. My ancestors are pioneering stock. This is no problem." And he said, "No, a woman is too weak and too fragile." And I said, "Arnie, women have run marathons throughout history. You know, there have been about six of them. And there was a woman, Roberta Gibb, who ran the Boston Marathon last year. She jumped out of the bushes without a number or anything, but she ran the race." And he said, "I don't believe any woman anywhere ever could run the Boston Marathon and has. It's ridiculous." Well, we argued. And finally, he said, "Look, if you'd show me in practice, I'd be the first person to take you." It was one of those kind of nya, 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 nyas. And I said, okay, man, you're on. And I trained and trained with him. And the day came when we were going to run the 26 miles in practice. When we finished it, he said, you know, you look so good. I can't believe you that you look so fresh. And I said, let's keep going. Let's run another 5 miles. That way, when we go to Boston, you know, I know no matter what, I can finish the race. And he said, you can run another 5 miles. And I said, sure, can't you? And he goes, anyway, we finished this 31 miles, but Arnie was out on his feet during the last mile. I could tell. I'm just weaving all over the road. And I was so excited. When we finished, I threw my arms around him. I said, we did it. We're going to Boston. And he passed out. And when he came to, he said, women have hidden potential in endurance and stamina. And we had discovered this whole new universe, you know, that women, in fact, the longer the race and the event got, the more endurance stamina we had. And so it was a real discovery, because we knew the guys, for some reason, on the cross country team wouldn't come out and run if it was longer than 15 miles. So Arnie was really like an evangelist after that over what women could do. And he said, this woman is incredible, you know, and we're going to go Boston together. And it was he who insisted I sign up for the race. And I thought Boston was just like this big sort of circus event. You know, you could just go up and jump in. And I said, Arnie, you know, why don't we just go and just jump in the race? You know, that other woman did last year. And he said, that was really wrong. This is a serious race. This is second only to the Olympic Games. You know, come on, you're a registered athlete with the Federation. You've got to pay your entry fee, which was $2.
Oh, Lord.
Big deal. Big deal in those days. You know, you got to get medical certificates. You got to register all of these things. So I said, okay. So I looked at the registration form and I said, Arnie, there's nothing about gender on this registration form. And he said, of course not. Nobody would believe that a woman could run or would want to run. And I said, well, look, maybe it's against the rules or something. He goes, I know you're going to say this. We got out the rule book and we checked, and there are no rules in the rule book about women entering the marathon.
Amazing. So you broke no rules.
I broke no rules, but that's not what they said after I ran it. Okay, believe me. So in the race now, you know, you told the story, and I'll tell it again briefly, is that we went on to Boston and I registered and they gave me bib number 261. But when I registered for the race, I signed my name KV Switzer. And I did this, I've done this since I was 12 years old, because my dad misspelled the Catherine on my birth certificate. And so every time people would talk about Catherine, they'd misspell my name. And I got really tired of it. And of course, I'm wanting to be a journalist. That's why I'm at Syracuse University. And, you know, who's cool writers? All the cool writers were J.D. Salinger and E.E. Cummings and T.S. Eliot and W.B. Yeats. So K.V. Switzer was kind of cool. So I signed KV Switzer. They thought it was from a man, and they thought I was trying to defraud them, which is totally untrue. I was simply following the rules. I wanted to go to Boston to run, not to prove anything. A woman had already run it the year before. I was there as a reward from my coach. And in the race, a mile and a half into the race, and all the guys, by the way, were wonderful to me, the runners. They were so welcoming, saying, I wish my wife would run. I wish my girlfriend would run. And they were saying, go for it. We're with you all the way. At a mile and a half, the press truck passed us and they were taking photographs and TV cameras are grinding away. Very excited. There's a girl in the race wearing a bib number. And the officials were on another bus, including the race director, a feisty guy by the name of Jock Semple from Scotland.
And you've never forgotten that name, right?
I've never forgotten that name. And he was the overseer of the marathon. And this marathon was his baby. And people were teasing him, journalists, saying, there's a girl in your race. He just lost his temper, jumped off the bus, went after me, and ran up behind me. I didn't see him until the last moment, and grabbed me and threw me back and said, get the hell out of my race and give me those numbers, and started clawing at the front of my shirt to pull off my bib numbers. And I jumped away and he grabbed me by the shirt, pulled me back and tried to get the number on my back. And oh my God, the cameras were going crazy. He did it in front of the press truck. I mean, really, the timing was just so bizarre. And for me, a 20-year-old girl being attacked in front of the world media, and the media screaming and yelling and everybody, chaos, right?
Right.
I was so terrified, really, and so ashamed and embarrassed. What was I going to do? I just tried to get away from him. Arnie, my coach, screaming, leave her alone. She's okay. I've trained her. And he smacked my coach. But alongside of me was running my boyfriend, who, by the way, it's another story, was only there because of a girl could run the marathon. He could run the marathon, but he happened to be a 235-pound all-American football player.
This is a novel.
I tell you. And he came and gave Jock Semple the most incredible, beautiful shoulder charge and sent him flying out of the race instead. And look, listen to you, Milan, you are laughing, right?
Right.
It is. That is a hilarious part of the story, right? Girl is saved by boyfriend. But it was a very ugly incident. And I was so scared and terrified. And I just took off. Arnie said, run. And so we ran down the street as fast as we could.
So you left the race or did you go on with the race?
No, just flying down the street. You know, I wasn't going to leave the race. The press truck went after us and we're asking, you know, when was I going to quit? When was I going to drop out? I was so angry then that I just turned to Arnie and the press. I said, I am going to finish this race. I'm going to finish this race with my hands and my knees if I have to. And everybody kind of went, oh, the press was laughing about it. And Arnie said, okay, let's calm down. Let's get it under control and slow down because the object is to finish now, no matter what. And I said, Arnie, if I don't finish this race, everybody is going to say what they always say to women, that women are always barging into places where they're not welcome and they can't do it anyway. And that's exactly what they were telling us. They were telling us that, you know, in jobs and universities and sports teams and things, they can't do it anyway. Well, of course you can't do it anyway if somebody attacks you like that. You know, either subversively or very overtly. And so I just said, okay, I'm finishing this race. And it was actually the sort of the defining moment in my life because I made that decision at 20. And I think the reason I could make that decision is I had felt so empowered from running. You know, ever since I was 12, I ran at least a mile a day and I felt like I had a victory under my belt. Nobody could take away from me. And now the big one, the big race that I really wanted to do, this guy was trying to prevent me from doing it. And I knew women could run if they only had the opportunity. Other women didn't know that. And the reason they didn't know that is because they were afraid. Nobody had given them the opportunity to try and believe in themselves. So it was quite an experience.
What happened at the finish line?
Well, I think more importantly is what happened going over Heartbreak Hill, because that's the crunch point in the race. Mm-hmm. It's 21 miles, and that's when you're operating on fumes.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, the anger had left me. I no longer was angry with the official. I knew he was simply a product of his time, and that it was up to me now to change his notions and other people's notions. But more importantly, I wanted to help women, because I knew other women weren't there because they were afraid. And they were afraid to take an opportunity to do something bold because sometime when they were about 12 or 13, back when my dad was encouraging me to run a mile a day, these girls were being told, to stop climbing trees and jumping rope and having fun. And it's time to start looking for a husband and know your place and not to sweat in public. So I said, okay, you know, I've got to somehow reach them. So when I got to the finish line, it was very anticlimactic because I felt very fresh then. I suddenly sort of had this life dream of what I wanted to do, which was one, become a better athlete, because I knew that 4 hours and 20 minutes was going to get me pilloried for being just a jogger. And the other one was to somehow create the opportunities. I didn't know what either one of those looked like, but that's what my feeling was coming across the finish line. And it wasn't like, oh, joy, because I was met again by a bunch of irascible journalists who had been standing out in the cold rain and slush and snow, which is what it had been for the entire race. It was very, very bad conditions. And there was no crowd. There was no fanfare. And we simply got interviewed by these guys and they gave me a lot of grief and I gave a lot of grief back. And then we went to a friend's house, got a shower and some food and a couple of beers. And we felt like Wasn't that the weirdest thing that happened? And we were really very, very happy about the fact that we had actually done the Boston Marathon. And then halfway home on the thruway, we stopped to get coffee and some ice cream to stay awake, and unfolded ourselves from the car and went into the cafe. And there we saw the newspaper stand. And there were papers from all over upstate New York and the East Coast there. And all of them already had the pictures of this event in the newspaper. And of course, the guys were all crowing like roosters in a barnyard. They were so excited to see their pictures in the paper. But for me, I realized that this was going to change my life and women's sports. And it was going to be a time for me to take really responsibility and figure out, you know, how to do it. But it was a real turning point. I often say in a marathon that this particular marathon, that I started that marathon as a girl and I finished it as a grown woman, because it just gave me the insight for the rest of my life.
Wonderful line, and what an amazing story, truly. Well, let's go back to the beginning for a second. Did you get into running because of your dad's suggestion?
Yes, definitely. Because I came home from elementary school, I was 12, and I was heading into a very big high school, from a country school to a big high school. And I was very nervous and prepubescent. And I realized that as silly as I thought they were, that cheerleaders were pretty and popular, got to date the captain of the football team. And I wanted to be pretty popular and accepted like any other little girl did. And I told my dad I wanted to be a high school cheerleader. And he said, no, you don't. He said, cheerleaders cheer for other people. You want people to cheer for you. He said, your school has something called a field hockey team. And if you ran a mile a day, you'd be the best player on it. I mean, you talk about motivating. Isn't that great?
Well, it's clearly in the DNA. I mean, that's a remarkable statement in and of itself.
Yep. And so I said, I couldn't possibly run a mile. And he said, sure, you can. I'll help you measure off the yard. It was 7 laps. And I tell you, and that stinking hot Washington, D.C. summer, which is where I grew up, I went did this mile every single day, and every single day, easy or impossible, without any rhyme or reason, I did the mile and I felt empowered. I felt like I had a victory nobody could take away from me. That was the turning point. It just changed my life. It made me feel like a really empowered kid when I went into that big high school, and I was impervious to the really weird behaviors that kids have and older students. And I realized, you know, I ran a mile today and you didn't. And it just made me feel like I could do anything, which is a great, great way for a kid to feel.
And a great lesson for you to give.
And every parent in the world should give their kid that opportunity to feel empowered. Mm. And all of us actually should give ourselves the opportunity to feel empowered. And if it's just as simple as putting one foot in front of the other, what can I tell you? It works. You know, I've created a nonprofit now called 261 Fearless, named after that bib number the official tried to pull off of me. It does just that. It creates a safe, welcoming, non-judgmental environment for women to take that first step in running or walking with a community of like-minded women. And they are becoming empowered, and it translates into every area of their life. It is quite phenomenal.
I was wondering what 261 Fearless stood for, so now I know.
Yeah, absolutely. And who would have ever imagined that old bib number would become this kind of cult number, meaning, you know, fearless in the face of adversity. It's really amazing.
Seneca's 100 Women to Hear will be back after this short break.
So being engaged in sports clearly is empowering. It's good for one's mental health, physical health, and even to develop leadership skills, right?
Absolutely, because when you know you can accomplish something that you previously thought impossible, it translates over to every area of your life. And whether that is asking for a raise or finishing an education or leaving a bad relationship or writing a book or taking on the organization of a whole new community or event or area in your workplace, it translates into everything you do. And certainly, you know, if you have the courage then to run 1 mile, you have the courage to run two, and then suddenly you run a marathon. You run a marathon, you can do damned anything.
Right, I should say. So you have this perspective now of many years, several decades. And in, I think it was 1972, you launched the Avon Running Circuit for women and championed women's official participation in distance races. So given this distance, this place where you are today, looking back, how has sports changed for women athletes? And what inequalities do we still have to address?
Yes, they are considerable. And I'm just going to go back to that 1972. Yes, that's when we campaigned and got official in the Boston Marathon for the first time. So we'd been running it now for 5 years. And we got, were made official. And from there, I was inspired to realize that women would run if they had the opportunity. And I created a proposal for Avon Cosmetics, and they hired me. And my dream was to get the women's marathon into the Olympic Games. Well, people thought I was a crazy person, but Avon didn't. They loved the way I could think. And we put on races, wait for it, in 27 countries and 5 continents, and gathered the statistics and participation from those events to present to the International Olympic Committee. And I've got to tell you that every country I went to, except for the USA, Canada, UK, and New Zealand, said I was a crazy person, that the women in those countries wouldn't run. And I said, if you give them the opportunity, they will run and will organize the race. And they said, yeah, but it won't be successful. A few women will show up. Well, the women came by their thousands. Their thousands. And one of the races in Brazil, in fact, had 6,500 women. It was one of the biggest road races in the world. And you can't ignore those kinds of statistics, and you can't ignore 6,500 women in shorts running through the streets of Rio de Janeiro. it changes people's notions. So we indeed did get the women's marathon into the 84 games. And in my view, that changed the landscape so much that to me, that was as important almost as giving women the right to vote. Because the right to vote was our intellectual and social acceptance after many, many years of fighting. Now, suddenly, this was like the physical acceptance, because the marathon is the longest distance race in running in the Olympic Games for men or for women. And it represented a total egalitarian now commitment from the International Olympic Committee, which I thought was absolutely huge. Also, because it was on television and 2.2 billion people watched the event as Joan Benoit Samuelson won. And everybody in the world knows how far 42.2 kilometers or 26.2 miles is, and they know it's far. So that really convinced a lot of people that women really did have the capability and deserved the opportunity. But then when you ask the question you just asked, which is what yet do we have to do? That's when I realized that's really great for women who can run in the Olympic Games or be good runners or want to be good runners. What about all the women out there in the world who have no opportunities? None whatsoever. That most of the women, even today, most women in the world still live in a fearful situation. And how are we going to reach them? And that's when we created 261 Fearless, which actually reaches out to them with this welcoming opportunity. Having said that, we have many other examples of women participating, not just in marathons, although that is huge because women have superior capability in endurance and stamina. As my coach and I discovered that day on that run, now women are winning outright. Ultra races, 6-day races, 24-hour runs, joining in teams with men, let's say a Grand Traverse, which is a 6-day race with 3 men, 3 women on the team. The men push the pace, but the women bring the team home always because we can, read the compass and they can't read the compass after 6 days of running. And what we're discovering is that women's capability is different from what men's capability is. It doesn't mean one athlete's better than the other. For instance, we will never have the speed, the power, and the sheer strength that men have, but men will never have the endurance, the stamina, the flexibility and balance that women have. Therefore, it makes us different athletes. Men have had sports events for 3,000 years in the Olympic Games. Women have had sports events roughly for about the last 50 years, and 100 years if you look at earlier Olympic competitions. But those that emphasize our unique abilities are very, very new, very new. This is a whole new look at the future of women's sports. And that will also bring us into even closer equality in terms of opportunity for creating events where we will excel. And also we can take then that notion, using sports even as the metaphor, take it to the business place, take it to the boardroom, where women bring a different dimension to business, to society, et cetera. It doesn't mean it's the same as men's. It doesn't have to be. In fact, it makes us an extremely good team of difference of opinion. We're just finally breaking through and understanding our differences create much better workplaces in terms of diversity and inclusion and equality. So these are very, very important notions that I have taken from sports. And I think it gives women and men a lot of insight and hope into how we can achieve together. Women's sports also bring a different image of how a traditional game is played. For instance, Billie Jean King introducing professional women's tennis was phenomenal. Everybody said it won't work. Nobody cares. Nobody's interested. They don't deserve equal prize money. Well, I submit that women's tennis is even more popular than men's because people can relate to the game more and think they absolutely deserve the equal prize money. And you see a different game. You see more strategy as well as the power and amazing athleticism that people like Serena Williams bring to the game. But the power isn't the same as the men's power. It's a different game. Soccer, interesting. I love soccer. I love the uniqueness and the power of the men's game, but I deplore the histrionics. And if you watch the women's game, it's a fabulous game to watch because the fouling and the histrionics aren't there, and all the strategy and beautiful goal playing is in place. And I think it's a wonderful game to watch. And also that those women deserve equal prize money. But it's going to be a while until the public is used to watching it, just like the change that took place in tennis. The thing is now, it is happening. And I think it creates amazing opportunities for us all.
It's truly happening. And I just think the perspective you just gave us is invaluable and wonderful to hear. And to hear how it affects leadership across the board.
Absolutely. The other thing, though, to realize is we really have an awfully long way to go. I mean, I've just finished talking to a friend of mine who has made a film about women running a marathon in Afghanistan on how incredibly dangerous and difficult this was to pull off, because they couldn't even announce the route and they had to have very, very sympathetic men running shotgun alongside of these women, because, you know, a woman who runs in Afghanistan probably is going to be thrown out of the house by her father, is pilloried, endangered by society. You know, it is very, very hard to overcome social, cultural, religious differences because they have been around for thousands of years, and the women themselves have no sense of what options they have. The internet is changing a lot of that, and the opportunities we can provide are changing a lot of that. Education is so, so key. It's just everything. It's so important. But still, we live in a world where there is such a disparity in this opportunity, and there's such a disparity in education. And poverty is, of course, the curse of all of us, because it restricts so much people's access to anything. If you don't have enough to eat and you're living in a terrible situation, sports is maybe the last thing that's on your mind. And yet somehow we can break through. I am very optimistic about that.
Well, and you're so right. Education is so fundamental. And now Having the links to the outside world and seeing what other women are able to do, for example. But I know with Afghan girls, it's been so difficult for them even to find spaces in which they can kick a ball around, for example.
Absolutely. And running a marathon, there's one woman who is in this marathon who only has this interior courtyard of her family home where she has to run. And I mean, how many thousands of laps of this courtyard she must have been doing just so she could complete the 26-mile distance. Phenomenal.
Well, it's like you doing that 1 mile, lap after lap in your backyard back when.
Yes, I can remember. Sometimes I thought I was never going to finish it. And other times I forget. I was so lost in thought that I'd forget how many laps I had done. So,
well, let me ask you, I know you're an author on top of everything else. And I know you're a successful author because just listening to you should make all of us run out and buy everything you've written. But you wrote a memoir, Marathon Woman. And you wrote a book called Running and Walking for Women Over 40. It's interesting. Why is running and walking so important for women in this age group?
Oh, phenomenally important. Yes, it was funny. It was a real fight with the publisher to get a women's book published first. You say that was half the population gone. And then the other, she said over 40, she said, you know, this isn't going to sail. And of course, it became a bestseller. And the reason being is over 40 is just about the time when a woman gets really nervous about her future because, you know, she suddenly thinks, oh my gosh, I'm gaining weight. You know, I'm looking ahead at menopause. My kids are grown up. I haven't achieved what I want to achieve. Often in this case, and other cases, they've stayed on top of their game and they want to go forward into their, older years, being fit and healthy. And I hasten to say, and I want to say this very encouragingly, that it is never, never too late to start a fitness program. You're never too old or big or slow. I mean, I've started women running at 70 and 75 and even 80, and they turn into very, very good, regular, healthy runners with wonderful results. So you're never too late, and it's never, never dangerous. I mean, so, you know, if all things being equal. So why is it so important also over 40? It's because in general, that's kind of the breakpoint in our lives of middle age. Like, you know, we've had mostly the kids, and it's time that we're starting to get either into full career swing or we are thinking about the other half and what does that look like? So, you know, staying fit your whole life is the easiest way to do this. And if you haven't, then here's a way. So that's why I wrote the Over 40 book. I was also inspired by my mother. Now, if you can imagine this, my mother, who was a wonderful inspiration to me, always was worked outside of the home, was a top educator. So one day she said to me when she was 70, I think, she'd been reading the Washington Post and she flung it down and she said, these articles in the paper are always telling us older women that we should exercise, but nobody is telling us how.
Mm.
And I looked at her and I said, Mother, you have been watching me for the last, 30 years, put on my shoes and go out and run. And she said, I don't know how to run. And I said, and besides, what kind of shoes? I said, I don't believe I'm listening to this from my own mother. And that's when I wrote my book. I said, if my own mother didn't get it. And I put her on a walking program. I took her out and got her fitted for a pair of shoes. And I said, look, all I want you to do is go up and down the driveway here, you know, and then I got her up and down the street and then around the block. Oh boy, she was away.
And so she began and continued.
She began and continued. And I got her up to about a 5K, but
wow.
I never got her into a race, which was always my dream, you know, is to get a bib number pinned on the front of my mother and to do the race with her. But and it was really funny. She'd come running over to me and she'd say, you know, I just like to get up really early in the morning and I love seeing the people outside and the flowers and the grass and the sun coming up. She said, but you know, Daddy wants me to stay in bed.
Oh.
So she was, you know, held back still by my father who said, oh, don't go out and walk today. Let's take it easy. Because he was feeling she was showing him up. And I said, Mother, you need to claim this space for yourself. And in the end, people respect you more for claiming that space. And so what I have told this again and again to women, you know, basically, you cannot be a martyr for your kids in your house. You deserve a half an hour to go outside and get some air and get some exercise. And people then respect you for it.
Wonderful story, wonderful wisdom. Let me just ask you, since we've come to the end of our time together, regrettably, what keeps you going? How do you keep going? How do you keep doing these marathons? Didn't you run a Boston Marathon at the age of 70? Maybe you've run several since, I don't know.
I have. And I want to tell you that day, I ran the Boston Marathon 50 years after my first one.
Oh my gosh.
I was the first woman to run a marathon 50 years after she first did it, which doesn't mean I'm great. It means how few women ran 50 years before. But what I wanted to show is that if you stay in shape your whole life, you can, you know, run a marathon again. Now, listen, anybody can get ill, get cancer. Anybody can get injured. Was I grateful for my fitness and my health? Absolutely. But also, I had worked at it. Not hard. I wasn't obsessive ever, except when I was training to be a really good athlete. Then I really, you know, was doing 100 miles a week. I mean, I was a crazy person, but I had a big chip on my shoulder. I really wanted to prove that I could be a very good athlete, and did, and won the New York City Marathon and you know, that kind of thing. But anyway, the 50th anniversary race was the happiest day of my life. And I'll tell you why. Because imagine being 50 years before, the first woman wearing a bib number in the Boston Marathon, the only woman in the race wearing a bib, being pilloried by the press, you know, heckled by some spectators, totally welcomed by the guys, which was very, very gratifying and validating. But then 50 years later, being surrounded by 13,500 women wearing a bib number. And everybody on the streets holding signs saying, go 261, go Catherine, women's equality. And the race being 50-50 men and women, and also having 125 women running for 261 Fearless, you know, my nonprofit, and their participation, they raised enough money to launch us globally, which was phenomenal. But also then to come down the finish line, and who was waiting for me at the finish line? Another woman who I believe is in the National Women's Hall of Fame. Her name is Joanne Flaminio, and she is the first woman president of the Boston Athletic Association in 135 years. And she is holding my medal for me to run into. And my husband waiting at the finish line with a big kiss, you know, which is everybody's romantic fantasy. You know, the lover is waiting for you at the finish line. And having that great sense that, hey, look, if you stay in shape, you know, you can do these amazing things. Yeah, I went on after that and ran the New York City Marathon, which I had won 43 years before, then ran the London Marathon, which was important to me. It was the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
What a joy it was to run with 25,000 women in the same streets that the suffragettes walked 100 years before. These are moments where running can bring me so close to our past history and help predict the future history. And I just feel so very, very strongly about what running and all sports can do for women.
Well, thank you for paving the way. You're an amazing storyteller, clearly an amazing, amazing athlete. You're the amazing Catherine Switzer. Thank you for leading the way and proving that women belong in running marathons and so much more. It's just been a joy to be able to talk to you today. And we thank you for your example and inspiration, and know that you'll certainly keep going. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been a joy being here.
What an amazing storyteller. Catherine continues to be an inspiration to women all over the world. Here are three things I took from today's conversation. First, from the day she ran that historic Boston Marathon, Catherine understood the importance of showing women strength. She knew she had to finish the race because there were women who were watching and who'd been told to stop playing sports or were afraid to do something bold, and she was running for them too. Second, as we've heard before in other conversations, sports can be tremendously empowering for women. It can be a path to leadership. As Catherine says, when you know you can accomplish something you previously thought impossible, it translates into every area of your life. Finally, sports shows the power of difference. Women athletes are different from men, not better or worse, just different. And so are women leaders. And we need those differences in every endeavor so we can all move forward together. To learn more about Catherine's global efforts for women, you can visit her nonprofit 261 Fearless at 261fearless.org. Tune in next Tuesday to hear about our next featured woman and discover why she's one of Seneca's 100 Women to Hear.
Seneca's 100 Women to Hear is a collaboration between the Seneca Women Podcast Network and iHeartRadio, with support from founding partner P&G. Have a great day.